has a lot of metaphors that are taken from nature. And I oftentimes have thought that if a person has some knowledge of agriculture as well as some knowledge of the heavenly bodies, that he may have a little insight into the Bible that other people don't have. Because a lot of times there are statements in the Bible that compare spiritual things to heavenly bodies, and at other times they are compared to things down here upon the earth. For instance, Christ called his people sheep. Well, a man that tends sheep would have a little insight into the understanding of what the Lord was presenting there to his people. He talked about the vine and the branches. Anybody that has any grapevines ever had to deal with them, he'd have some understanding about what he meant when he spoke about the vine and the branches. Well, tonight he's going to talk about five things out of the natural realm, and they all set forth what apostates are like. Now, Peter has his description over there in 2 Peter chapter 2, about verse 17 and 18, if I remember. But he is not near so good at it as Jude. And Jude gives us five descriptions of what apostate teachers are like. And to me, they are the best that you'll ever find anywhere in the Bible. They're found in verse 12 and 13 of our little book that we study tonight. And I'm going to just read the two verses, because I hope to be able to finish both of them. And I'm sorry to say that in verse 12, the first part is somewhat obscured by our King James Version. And I'll straighten it out some when we come back to it. These are spots in your feast of charity, when they feast with you, feeding themselves without fear. Clouds, they are without water, carried about of winds, trees whose fruit withereth, without fruit, twice dead, plucked up by the roots, raging waves of the sea, foaming out their own shame, wandering stars, to whom is reserved the blackness of darkness forever. There were five things mentioned there. The first is obscured. Now, our version reads like this at the beginning of verse 12. These are spots in your feast of charity. It is regrettable that our translators have put in the word spots. If you'll get down your concordance and look up the Greek words there, there is one Greek word that means spot. It's spelled almost exactly like the word that occurs here in Jude, except there's a little variation. And that is the word, incidentally, that is used over in Peter. It is the word that means spots or blemishes. However, the word that is translated here, spot, is a word for rock. For rock, R-O-C-K. And it means rocks, and that's how it ought to be translated. And so you say, well, now, what sort of rocks is it? Well, in the original, it means hidden rocks in the sea, or what we'd call a reef. When I was in the West Indies, I went out and I saw a lot of reefs. That's rocks that stick up underneath the water. You can't see them until you get right over the top of them like. And they can be very devastating to a wooden ship, especially like in the time of the New Testament. And so what he's talking about here is he's saying that these are hidden rocks in your feast of charity. So these apostates are like a reef that might cause a ship to shipwreck. And that's pretty well what he has under consideration there. Another thing that I would point out, that when you think about a rock, you always think about something that would cause a man maybe to stumble. And in the case of unseen rocks, then there would be a shipwreck. That was the danger of the old wooden ships. The rocks would tear them to pieces. So, well, what about this feast of charity? That is, again, another regrettable translation. In the Greek, it is just one word, love feast. Just one word, love feast is what it means. The love feast are indirectly referred to in the Bible. This is probably one of the most direct statements that you'll ever find about them. And, of course, it goes back to that Greek word agape, which is the word for love, very strong love, incidentally. But it's a love feast. And so, what was the love feast? Well, it seems that in 1 Corinthians 11, we have some information about that. The love feast was a supper they had before they had the Lord's Supper. It was like having two suppers the same night. Now, let's go over there, and I'll show you some things that I am convinced that they had combined the agape, or the love feast, as I would call it, with the Lord's Supper. Because there were certain things going on here at the Lord's Supper that don't normally go on. And so they had combined the love feast and the Lord's Supper. And Paul criticized not so much the way they were taking the Lord's Supper as the way they were taking the agape. Now let's start in 1 Corinthians there at verse 20. When you come together therefore into one place, this is not to eat the Lord's Supper. For in eating, everyone taketh before other his own supper, and one is hungry and another is drunken. Sound like quite a feast going on. What, have you not houses to eat and drink in? I don't know the way that reads there, rather than saying that you ought not to eat and drink in the church. I think what he's telling them is they ought not to have the love feast, maybe, especially if it's going to take away from the holiness of the Lord's Supper. What, have you not houses to eat and drink in, or despise ye the church of God, and shame them that have not? Now, how did they shame them that have not? Well, rich people had a lot of food to bring. They could eat good. Poor people didn't have much food, and some of them were sitting there hungry, mouths just watering to have a good meal, and they wouldn't let them have any, I assume. What shall I say to you? Shall I praise you in this? I praise you not. And then he goes on there to tell about the Lord's Supper. But you'll note there he said that one's hungry and another is drunk. In other words, one fellow's had too much, the other hadn't had enough of this or that. So it was a feast that they inaugurated without any clear scripture whatsoever. It was never commanded and became something that was abused by the early churches and was finally abolished. And today we do not have any love feast. I have not known any church to have a love feast in centuries. So it was something that they originated on their own. There was no command for it. It evidently tended in a bad direction, and they finally just discontinued it entirely because it seemed to be more of a curse than a blessing. So these love feasts were more or less abused by wealthy church members. They would bring out a great abundance, and everybody would eat until they were about ready to pop, and the others would sit over there, like I said, and be hungry and have nothing to eat. And so what was happening there, this love feast was being abused by wealthy members. But there was another problem that Jude's speaking about. You had apostate teachers there in the church partaking of that feast. And he said that these apostate teachers are like unseen rocks to a ship out in the sea. In other words, they're dangerous to our church. Now you note that these people were there in the church because he said, when they feast with you, when they feast with you, feeding themselves without fear. They were eating there the love feast with the church members and all of that. And I don't know, I think sometimes today that we have a little revival of the love feast or something, because some churches would rather feed people food than to feed them the Word of God. And that seemed to be the problem they had with the agape feast, or the love feast, because it tended in the same direction there. But now, for a little bit, just concentrate on that statement there, feeding themselves without fear. They were not exercising any holy fear in what they were doing in the church. In other words, they were not showing any respect for the house of God. They were not showing any respect for the men of God. They were not showing any respect for the Word of God and the people of God. And I've studied a long time what is meant by that statement there. Feeding themselves without fear. That seems to mean that they were getting satisfaction out of leading people astray in the church. Like a man gets satisfaction out of food, they were getting satisfaction out of leading people into error, because it was forwarding their own purpose. And so they use these feasts to satisfy their own carnal purposes. They use them to satisfy their own appetites and to further their own base ends in the church. Feeding themselves. Literally there, it can be rendered from the Greek text, shepherding themselves. In other words, it would be like a shepherd either eating the flock rather than feeding the flock, or it would be like a shepherd taking care of himself and forgetting all about the sheep. Maybe one of the two ideas can be seen there. Shepherding themselves. I guess that would be a man that claimed to be a shepherd that was making himself like he was a sheep. In other words, he is getting all the benefit. That's the problem with false teachers. Many of them feed themselves, and they do not feed the flock of God. So instead of feeding the sheep, they were fleecing the sheep. That was a terrible, terrible thing. Now let me show you some statements that are made about false prophets in the book of Isaiah. And I think how this certainly does reveal some of the religious racketeers that we have on TV and radio today. When you see them all diked out in their fine clothes, you can tell that they're not poor folks. Now look at Isaiah 56, verse 10 and verse 11. Speaking here about false prophets, they would compare with the false teachers, the apostate teachers in the churches in the days of Jude. His watchmen are blind. They are all ignorant. They're all dumb dogs. Sometimes, you know, we make these heretics appear to be pretty good folks, you know, just a little bit confused about the Bible. Isaiah didn't have a lot of use for them. He said, it reminded me of a bunch of dumb dogs. He had pretty strong language for them. They cannot bark, sleeping, lying down, loving to slumber. Now watch. Yea, they are greedy dogs. Now compare that with the statement here, feeding themselves in Jude. Which can never have enough. They are shepherds that cannot understand. They all look to their own way, every one for his gain from his quarter. In other words, like we've said before, they were money preachers. Now turn in your Bible to the 34th chapter of the book of Ezekiel. Look there at verse 2 and 3. Son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Prophesy and say unto them, thus saith the Lord God unto the shepherds, woe be to the shepherds of Israel that feed themselves. Compare that statement over there, feeding themselves. Should not the shepherds feed the flocks? Ye eat the fat, and ye clothe you with the wool. Ye kill them that are fed, but ye feed not the flock. So the false prophets in the Old Testament had exactly the same characteristics as the false teachers of the New Testament. They were out for their own selfish benefits. They did not care anything about the people of God. They were hirelings that didn't care for the sheep. Now there's another little lesson that we learn here, and that is that whenever we have a feast, whether it be secular or sacred, it ought to be done in the fear of God, because these people didn't have any fear of God. You say, well, we're going to have a fellowship supper in the church, then do it in the fear of God. So, well, we're just going to have a supper here or there. You better do it in the fear of God. Do you remember what Job did? Look over there in chapter 1 of the book of Job. It said there that his sons and daughters would meet in one of the son or daughter's house, I assume, and they'd feast every day. They'd enjoy themselves, have a good meal. Nothing wrong with that. But Job was afraid that it might take him away from the things of God. He was afraid the carnal might somehow go contrary to the spiritual. And look what he says there in verse 5. And so it was so, when the days of their feasting were gone about, that Job sent and sanctified them, and rose up early in the morning, and offered burnt offerings according to all the number of them all. For Job said, it may be, didn't say they had now, It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their heart. Thus did Job continually. The lesson is that sacred feast should be celebrated in the fear of God. Now, Jesus Christ is certainly the rock of our salvation, but these apostate teachers were hidden rocks threatening to shipwreck the people's faith. And Paul in 1 Timothy 1 and 19 talked about some people that had their faith shipwrecked. Fits very well with what we're reading here in the book of Jude. Then we want to go on to note the next description, because we can easily get bogged down here in one, and there's so much good material we want to look at before we finish our lesson. He goes on then to talk about the next group there that are rainless clouds or waterless clouds, whichever way you'd like to say it. Clouds that are without water, carried about of winds. Waterless clouds of false promise. Have you ever seen clouds like that? Usually about August and September here when it gets real dry and everybody'd like to have rain and don't have any rain. Sometime a very dark like cloud will come up and we'll say, well, surely we're going to get some rain this time. But it'll come over and it'll pass from here to there and not a drop of rain will come out of it. What is that? It is a cloud without water. It seems to promise a refreshing rain, but nothing comes from it. Well, you see, these apostate teachers are clouds without water. They promise a refreshing of the soul, but they don't deliver it. Nothing comes of it. They have nothing whatsoever that refreshes the soul of their hearers. So false teachers look like rain clouds. They boast of great gospel light and great knowledge, but they don't have any salvation. They don't have any doctrinal truth, and they're so disappointing to the people of God. I guess we might say that they turn out a lot of dry sermons. Let me tell you what, over the years I've heard some that was pretty dry. I don't know whether it was as dry as one old man that I heard about one time out in the country over in the state of Alabama. He was preaching one Sunday morning there in his church, and his sermon outline blew out the window and went out in the pasture where the old cow was, and the old cow ate it, I guess, thinking it was grass, and they said she went dry after that. So that would be a pretty dry sermon. I've heard some that almost could qualify on that, because indeed they're very, very dry. In the book of Proverbs, we're told something very much like what we have here in chapter 25 and verse 14. Whoso boasteth himself of a false gift is like clouds and wind without rain. Waterless clouds of false promise. That's what they are. They don't have the water of life in them. They're bone dry. They're like Ezekiel's bones. They're dry bones. That's all they are. Now, these false teachers, like clouds without water, can only deceive and discourage those that really thirst for the water of life. Worse than that, they darken the sky of true believers and dim their vision of the Son of Righteousness. I think a lot about how they're compared here to something that is dry. Do you remember over there in Matthew 12 and 43 when it talked about the unclean spirit that left this man, said he what? He walked through dry places, D-R-Y, dry places, like clouds without water. See, it's dry. When you really compare the verse we have here in Jude with that verse over there in Matthew, you see these clouds without water really are nothing in the world but false preachers, false teachers that are controlled by demon spirits. And back behind all heresy is demonic power. That ought to scare a man if he'd really think about that very long. You better be sure to preach the truth, lest you be guilty of preaching the doctrine of demons. 1 Timothy 4 and 1 tells us about that. Then it said, carried about of winds. Have you ever seen these clouds? Just a few days ago, right after that rain, I stood out on the back porch, and I saw clouds going different directions, some low toward the ground, some way up high, all going different directions. And as I looked at those clouds, I realized they were carried about of the wind, just like he describes here. Now, another remarkable thing is that the word that is translated wind can also be translated spirit. It's the same word in the original text. And so again, there's a little indirect hint there about the demon spirits being in these apostate teachers. A cloud has to go wherever the wind carries it. And a false prophet will go in his doctrinal era as far as the demon will take him. That's a scary thing to me to think about. These rainless clouds never give any showers of blessing. They do not bring any life or fruitfulness. You know, right after rain, it's always a beautiful sight to note how that all the little plants will just spring up and look like overnight they just take off growing and no way to stop them. You plant a seed in the ground, it'll lay there for weeks, no rain, no moisture, it won't come up. A little rain can come and it'll spring up overnight almost. But you see, these false teachers, they cannot give out any spiritual life. They cannot give out any spiritual fruitfulness because they don't have any. A stream never rises above its source. Well, Christ comes like a cloud to refresh us forever and forever. But false teachers, like rainless clouds, do not even bring a temporary blessing to the hearers. They're clouds without water. Clouds, waterless clouds, a false promise, that's all they are. Promise everything and deliver nothing. Then the next description is about autumn trees that speaks of a barren profession. Trees whose fruit withereth, without fruit, twice dead, plucked up by the roots. And again, I have to go back to my knowledge of agriculture in order to understand this verse as I should. This last week, I was walking down there on the hillside, and I looked at one of my apple trees. All of the Jonathan apples have long since been gone, because it's late in the fall. The fruit is all gone. But I looked away up high on one of those trees, and there was a little black object, probably no bigger than maybe a half a dollar or a quarter. And I knocked it down for curiosity to look it over. It was an apple that had dried up completely. Was hard. You couldn't eat it. It wasn't good for anything. It was a dead apple if I ever saw one. And so I think that helped me to understand this passage here, because he said, trees whose fruit withereth. Well, what I saw there was some fruit that had withered. But the sad thing was, it was the only thing on the tree, and in the main, you could say that tree was without fruit. You couldn't eat the withered fruit, and there wasn't any of the good, so it was without fruit, right? Well, that's how I think he had in mind here. And so these trees whose fruit withereth, late autumn trees, trees that are like trees right now out on the hillside, where all the foliage and all the fruit's gone. And so the idea is that these apostate teachers are useless and fruitless. That little apple that I knocked down there off of that tree wasn't good for anything, unless you wanted to use it like a rock to throw at a dog or something. It's about all it had been good for. And I'll tell you what, that next expression there has stumped the minds of the best theologians. Twice dead. And people will come back and say, first of all, how could a tree be twice dead? They have a problem with the autumn tree. And then they turn around and say, here's a lost preacher, he's spiritually dead. How can he be twice dead? He's still alive physically. He's teaching, so he can't be physically dead. How can he be twice dead? Like I said, that stumped some of the best people. Well, again, let's go back to the metaphor that's being used here. Christ used it one time in the Bible, in one of his parables. You know, this man had a tree that didn't bear any fruit. He said, let it alone another year. And said, if it don't bear any fruit, said, I'll cut it down and we'll burn it in the fire then. So what I see here, and the only thing that makes any sense to me when he talks about twice dead, is like a tree that doesn't have any leaves or any fruits, and it's been that way for 2 years straight. gone through two seasons. Didn't have any foliage, didn't have any fruit. So it's proven itself to be dead twice. It's gone through two seasons. I believe that is a metaphor, but now what is the meaning of it when it comes to the spiritual implication there? How can you call apostate teachers twice dead? Well, they are dead in a twofold sense. And you ought to read some of the theories of some of these fellows. I'm not going to waste your time talking about them. Some of them are almost comical. But anyway, that's beside the point. How could they be said there to be twice dead? Well, first of all, they are spiritually dead in trespasses and sins. They've never been saved. But you know, they profess to be saved. Like the church at Sardis, they have a name to live when they're dead. So they are spiritually dead, and they are dead in their false profession. So apostates are dead in sin and dead in a false profession. They have a name to live, but they're lifeless. So in that sense, they're twice dead. And then I want you to think a little bit about the statement there, plucked up by the roots. Let me ask you something. If you go out here and take a small tree in the hot summertime and you pull it up out of the ground, we'll say in August to make it very graphic in its description, and let it lay out there on top of the ground with all of its roots exposed to the sun and the air for about a month, what will that tree be? Well, somebody might say it'll be as dead as a dodo bird, be dead as a doornail, be dead as a passenger pigeon. It's dead. Now, you can put that thing back down in the ground covered over with dirt, but it won't live. It's dead. It's dead. Now, if you want a symbolism of reprobation, you've got it right there. So, was anybody in the Bible that can't be saved? It would seem to me that false teachers can't. They're like a tree that's been pulled up by the roots and left exposed to the hot sun and air. They're dead. They're twice dead. So, if you want some information there about reformation, any tree that is plucked up by the roots has to speak of an individual that is beyond the possibility of coming into spiritual life, therefore reprobate. People say, well, the Bible don't teach reprobation. It does right here. And then you remember a statement that Christ made in Matthew chapter 15 and verse 13. So fitting to what we have here. Every plant which my heavenly Father hath not planted shall be rooted up. Then you can go over here to the book of Proverbs chapter 2, verse 22. But the wicked shall be cut off from the earth, and the transgressor shall be rooted out of it. Plucked up by the roots, beyond the possibility of spiritual life, a reprobate. Now, while false teachers are compared here to trees that are twice dead and all of that plucked up by the roots, the children of God are compared just to the opposite of that. Listen to Psalms 1 and 3. Talks about the blessed man, the godly man. He shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water that bringeth forth his fruit in his season. His leaf also shall not wither, and whatsoever he doeth shall prosper. Then in the book of Jeremiah, you have the figure used again, even this time in a more detailed fashion in verse 7 and 8. Chapter 17, verse 7 and 8. Blessed is the man who trusteth in the Lord and whose hope the Lord is. For he shall be like a tree planted by the waters, and that spreadeth out her roots by the river, and shall not see when heat cometh. Her leaf shall be green, and shall not be careful in the year of drought, neither shall cease from yielding fruit. So the child of God is compared to an evergreen tree that's always bearing fruit. Fruit of the righteous is a tree of life, also in the book of Proverbs. Well, you see, Christ is our tree of life, but these false teachers are trees of death. We expect a tree to have life, and if it's dead, it's not good for anything. Then he gives this fourth description here. It said, raging waves of wasted efforts. Raging waves of the sea, foaming out their own shame. They're restless in their passions as the wild waves of the sea, pouring forth their shame like foam. You know, in the book of Isaiah, chapter 57, verse 20 and 21, it said, "The wicked are like the troubled sea when it cannot rest. They cast up mire and dirt and all of that." The remarkable thing about it is that waves make a lot of noise. Let me tell you what, false prophets make a lot of noise sometimes, but they don't have any substance. So, like waves, they're noisy and bold in profession, but they are ungovernable in their passions as the billows of the sea. Can you go out and tame the waves of the sea? No more can you reform many of these false prophets either. You might have as much, you probably would have about as much success with taming the waves of the sea as trying to convert them from the error of their way. Foaming out their own shame. Their doctrines are as valueless as the foam of the ocean waves, and they do nothing more than just proclaim their own shame from day to day. I tell you what, Christ leads beside the still waters. Wicked are like the troubled sea. Christ though leads his sheep by the still waters. Still waters are deep waters. But you see, these false teachers are like the restless sea. And so it speaks there of raging waves of wasted effort. They do all these great things for God, never amounts to a hill of beans. Worthless. And to me, the next part of the verse is the most fearful description of hell anywhere in the Bible. Some would disagree with that, but I think it is to me. Wandering stars to whom is reserved the blackness of darkness forever. Again, I think what he's talking about there is wandering stars on an aimless course. We call them shooting stars. Have you ever gone outside on a dark night when it's very clear? Especially this time of the year is a very good time to do it, when the sky is very clear. Stand and look, and every once in a while you'll see a meteor fall into the atmosphere of the earth. It'll catch on fire, and it'll burn as it comes down through the air, make a brilliant light. And before it hits the ground, most of the time, it turns black. It goes out. Shooting stars. That's the kind that he's talking about here. So these apostates are like erratic meteors, meteors of fire that soon burn out and turn to darkness. But you know, in the Bible, true believers are compared to fixed stars in the moral heavens, because in the book of Revelation, in chapter 1 and chapter 2, the pastors are called the seven stars. But they're fixed in the hands of Christ, you see. Stars mean very little to us sometime today, but back in the time when the Bible was written, they meant a great deal, especially to people that traveled to the sea. They set their course with the North Star and all this kind of stuff. There are natives still on some of the South Sea Islands in the Pacific that governs their ships and their travel from island to island by the stars. Even in this modern day, they still do it the old-fashioned way. I saw them some time ago on the Educational Channel doing just that. Well, now, what good would a wandering star be? I mean, the reason they can govern their ship by the North Star is because it's something they know where it is at all times, where it's supposed to be and all that. But a wandering star wouldn't be worth a thing to a man traveling the sea. Because it'd be here today and over here tomorrow and wouldn't be worth anything. Well, let me tell you what, false prophets, that's how much you're worth, nothing. They're worthless, like a shooting star. May give a little light for a time, at least look real good, but they'll burn out. There's nothing to them. Nothing to them. So wandering stars would be useless to seamen, and they are also useless to the churches. And then he talks about their final doom there when he says the blackness of darkness forever. Again, our version obscures it a bit. It actually just says the blackness of darkness is darkness of darkness. So, well, why would he repeat himself? The Jews, in many of their very old books, compares what we call hell to the darkness of Egypt. That goes deep into Jewish antiquity. There was something remarkable about that darkness on the land of Egypt. The Bible said it was a darkness that could be felt. You ever thought about that statement? The darkness that could be felt is so dark, so black dark, you could feel it. Well, evidently the darkness of hell is going to be a darkness that can be felt. Most of us like the darkness while we sleep. But who would want to live in darkness forever and forever? To me, that would be the most horrible thing in the world. I hear a lot of people say, well, if I go to hell, I'm not going to worry about it. There'll be plenty of people down there with me. Now, wait a minute. I'd have to agree with you that if a fellow goes to hell, there'll probably be a lot of people down there in hell with him. I'd agree with that. But you wouldn't know who they are because it's dark and you're just stumbling around in the dark all the time and the fire is burning, but yet it's dark. Fire that does not bring light but brings darkness. Think about it. What kind of fire is that? It's a horrible thing. Always remember that Russian cosmonaut. His rocket played out on him up in space. And they left him up there to wander till he died. I mean, there's no way he could get down. There's no way he could come home. No way he could ever be recovered. They had no other ship to send up to get him. It must have been a horrible death to just be wandering around up there in space until finally you ran out of air, food, and everything, and you died. That was bad, but to be wandering stars to whom is reserved the blackness of darkness forever is worse. Poor man may have gone from that awful state into this blackness of darkness that I'm reading about here. I've often wondered about that. Don't know his heart. But it says reserved there. And that means reserved for them among the treasuries of God's divine wrath. They're reserved to everlasting fire. Well, Christ is a bright and morning star that heralds the coming day. Apostate teachers are shooting stars that herald the night of eternal darkness. What a description we have here. What a description we have. Unseen rocks, clouds without water, autumn trees, raging waves of the sea, shooting stars. None of it is worth very much. Doesn't amount to very much. Neither does heresy. Never amounts to very much. Neither do heretics. Except perhaps to have some of the praise of men before they stand before God, and then they'll find out they're going to be reserved to the blackness of darkness forever. And the eternal aspect of hell is seen there in that word forever. You're not going to hell for vacation. You're going there forever and forever, according to the Bible. Everlasting punishment. The Bible teaches it. Well, let us stand as we sing.